Good afternoon. My name is David Marquis. For 25 years, it was my great honor and privilege to work with and to know Glenn Mitchell. This afternoon is my great honor and sad duty to officiate at this public memorial service, a celebration of the life of Glenn Mitchell. Your presence honors Glenn, and we thank you on behalf of the family and all of us who love him so much. The immediate and generous offer of these facilities by the Dallas Theater Center honors Glenn. We thank them. The overwhelming outpouring of support and love by Glenn's friends and colleagues at KERA honor Glenn. And we thank them. We thank each of you for being here today. One day last week, I walked into the kitchen and I turned on the radio as I do every day just at noon. Glenn wasn't there. A tear came to my eye. A knot of emotion rose from my chest into my throat. And my old friend, grief, paid a visit. Grief is like the ocean. It washes over you like waves. And what are we to do? To fight the ocean? You can't do that. You let it wash over you. You watch it as it rolls away. And know that it will be back. It will affect our appetites, our sleep, our hearts. And yet, as I go through this pain and this grief, it is something that we go through. I ask myself, what sure knowledge can I take from it? What can I gain from it? What have I learned from it? Because I learned so much from Glenn Mitchell. And Glenn Mitchell loved to learn. Of all the things I learned from Glenn, I have distilled it down to three. One is that the art of conversation is not dead. Two is that a curious mind is one of God's greatest gifts. And number three is that quality still matters more than quantity. We measure everything today in our world. We measure our children by how they score on their standardized tests. The body politic is corrupted daily by polling data and numbers. And yet, on the Glenn Mitchell show, statistics did not hold sway. We did not hear every day that 72% of these believe that and 48% of those believe this. Glenn knew better. He knew that the quality of things that cannot be measured matters more than the quantity of those things that can. He knew that the quality of thought outweighs the quantity of opinions. And so that leaves us then with no way to measure the effect of Glenn Mitchell if we don't do it with numbers. But we wouldn't do it that way because Glenn taught us better. We know better because he taught us better. And knowing becomes believing. And believing explodes into faith. And I have faith today, right now, that somewhere in this city today, a journalist will write a better story, will do more research because they listened to Glenn Mitchell. That somewhere a young political science student will understand issues more deeply, and someday they will run for office and be a better public servant because they listened to Glenn Mitchell. And somewhere tonight in this city, a child will ask a parent a question, and that parent will turn to that child and without even realizing that it's Glenn's influence will say, "That's a good question. Let's look it up." And someday that child will have a child and Glenn Mitchell's influence will live on. And in this cynical world, we know that thirst for knowledge and commitment to excellence and love of learning still matter. And in this part of the world, we know that in large part because of the life and work of Glenn Mitchell. Linda Mitchell Bland is Glenn's sister.
My brother was the meanest croquet player on this planet in 1961. Poised with accuracy and cunning, he would smack my ball into the oblivion of the neighbor's yard, where usually, because of him, I would stay for most of the game. And with the indignant rage of a little sister, I'd yell, "You read girl books. You read Nancy Drew. And you still sleep with Big Bear." But by that time, he had already made it to the end stake, and leaning on his mallet like a knight leaning on his sword of victory, he would flash me that infamous quirky smile that would make my blood boil. He savored the process because the surprise was at the end. Glenn really did read Nancy Drew, and I think he had the whole set. But Glenn never grasped the concept of instant gratification. He never read the end of the book first. He savored the process because the surprise was at the end. Christmas, of course, was a favorite process. It was savored with music, all kinds, food, grape pie, and anything coconut, stories, read, memorized, and quoted, and staying up late to watch A Christmas Carol, the black and white version, hot chocolate and marshmallows. And if Glenn could get away with it, he would do all of his Christmas shopping on Christmas Eve and stay up all night wrapping. When he and I would wake up in the middle of the night on Christmas, he would never let me peek or open anything. He would, sorry, Mom, it was me. But he would savor the process because the surprise was at the end. Glenn actually was in the public eye as a baby. A picture of Glenn and our mother was used in a milk company advertisement. And I always thought that was really cool. And he was pretty humble about it, saying, "Yes, I was utterly adorable." Glenn's love of words was an early process. He named our grandmother Ammo because he couldn't say Grandmother Lois. I was Booga. A rabbit in our family will always be a boo-rah, and hot ginger snaps from the oven are goo-rahs. And his name, Gimo, or Gee, because he couldn't say Glenn William. Mama Glenn's whispering again. When we were little and on a trip, they'd stick us in the same room at night, and I couldn't sleep because he was talking. Now I realize he was rehearsing. He had either read or heard something that he was making his own, tumbling and savoring the words until they fit. I want to thank each of you for coming today and to celebrate and savor the process of Glenn's life. His surprise, maybe an interview with Babe Ruth, Socrates, Plato, Will Shakespeare, Dickens, Thurber, Nero, Richard Nixon. Glenn, because of you, I will always remember that words are magic. I love you, Bubba.
Wow. I'm Jeff Luxinger, station manager of KERA 90.1, and it's an honor for me to stand before you today and talk for just a couple of minutes about Glenn and KERA. For those of us at the station, one of the most difficult things about Glenn's passing is that he was literally a touchstone to the past, the present, and the future of KERA. I mean, as Bob Ray Sanders has noted, he was there when the station signed on the air. And Glenn Mitchell's show was headed for satellite radio. But in the early days, Glenn was management. He was management at 90 FM. He didn't talk much to us about that, but that's how much he wanted to work in radio, and at KERA, he was willing to become management. I don't think I liked it much. And so he went on to do other things. He worked on the TV side at KERA. He anchored the National Business Network, Financial Satellite Network. He taught, he wrote, he worked at other radio stations. But he kept coming back to KERA radio. When I arrived at KERA about 20 years ago, Glenn was doing pieces for the station and for National Public Radio. These were called the Unabridged Glenn Mitchell. They were stories he produced on his own. And my first job at the station was to come in and help our morning edition anchor at the time, Marla Crockett, write news and produce other local elements for morning edition. I knew of Glenn, but you didn't see him around much during the day. However, I would find evidence that he existed. I would go into one of the two tiny production rooms in our little old red schoolhouse studios at about 4 a.m., and I would find bits of tape and empty coffee cups and half-empty coffee cups and notes and God knows what else in the studio. You see, Glenn was not organized in the conventional sense. If you take a look at the photo of his desk outside the doors of the theater, you can see what I mean. But, you know, the photo doesn't really do Glenn's workspace justice, and Tom may hurt me for this, but he has referred to Glenn's work area as a landfill with Katie Awards. Sorry if I'm stealing one of the lines, Tom, but to me that's just perfect. Then there were the Christmas blockbuster shows. For 31 consecutive years, Glenn produced 12 and on at least one occasion 24 hours of music, stories, interviews, and the errata of the holiday season. He examined the ancient origins of the celebration, and he played the latest and the best music. He also played some of the most obscure music of the season, but I don't think he ever played The Little Drummer Boy. He hated that song. There will be a special Christmas blockbuster this year. We just started working on it yesterday, and it will air on December 18th, beginning at noon. Thank you. Finally, for the last 10 years, we had the pleasure of joining Glenn Monday through Friday for, as he called it, the talk show. When we were looking at the field of candidates to replace Karen Dennard when she left, Glenn was the clear winner. I have often referred to him as a walking encyclopedia, but the Glenn Mitchell Show was more than that. It was the quirky theme music created by Kim Corbett. It was the background work by the show's producers, Susan Shuey, Kelly Pound, and most recently Jeff Whittington, and interns too numerous to mention. It was the board work of Jeannie Mascoro, Eric Bright, and Justin Martin, and it was the gentle guidance, okay, sometimes not so gentle guidance, of Abby Goldstein. It was the way Glenn came back from every break with, "Welcome back." He wrote each and every opening to each and every show. And he found a way to set up the topic so well. He had that rare ability to invite you into the conversation. He knew more about more things than any other person I have ever met. But he never tried to impress you with his knowledge, unless you were somehow trapped into a game of Trivial Pursuit with him. You did not want to play Trivial Pursuit with Glenn Mitchell. That's when his competitive side really showed. Then, and when he would stick his head in my office on a monthly basis and make the case to take the show national. He was convinced we could kick every other talk show's butt. From signing the station on to the Glenn Mitchell Show to the internet stream to listening on the sly at work to satellite radio, Glenn has been a vital part of the past, the present, and the future of KERA 90.1. I'd like to close by quoting just a few of the many, many comments made by our audience on the web forum about Glenn. You don't know how much Glenn loves spending those 2 hours with you every day. And you, the listeners, are the only reason that the Glenn Mitchell Show, or KERA, exist. One listener wrote, "Glenn's show was one of the few and increasingly rare places in the media where intelligence and open-mindedness and cordiality coexist freely." Another said, "But the real prize arrived on Friday with everything you ever wanted to know." Actually, it's anything you ever wanted to know, but we could never make anyone understand that. "Sometimes you knew the answer, sometimes you would guess, and other times you had no idea why anybody would even want to know the strangest of queries. But even then, you couldn't wait for the answer." Well, he has all the answers now. You can bet on that. And finally, if it's true that small minds talk about people, mediocre minds talk about events, and great minds talk about ideas, then Glenn Mitchell was undeniably a great man. Amen to that. Glenn Mitchell was a great man. We will go on, but we will miss him terribly for a long, long time.
Hi, my name is David Johnson, and Glenn and I first met, I still don't know exactly. I think it was probably late 1973, maybe early 1974. We were both hanging around Channel 13. I was about a year out of Swanee, and he was like 1 foot out of SMU. He never completely went to SMU. He sort of spent time at Channel 13, and they'd spend time at SMU and kind of back and forth. When I first met him, he was, I think he was doing the mail at Channel 13. But then, but Glenn could do anything. Later on, he was the telephone operator at Channel 13. Now, I want you to think about calling Channel 13 to just bless him out about that obscene Monty Python show that was on in the 1970s, and having Glenn maybe suggest just the right word to get the message through, or maybe to correct your English, your choice of words. That was Mitchell, but again, Mitch could do anything. We really worked together for the first time at one of the first and one of the probably most dreadful Channel 13 auctions, or as it was known around Channel 13, the annual Death March. Bob Ray will remember 12-hour shifts and losing voices, and children were conceived during the 2-week period. People found the joys of alcohol. It was a real bonding experience. Mitch would lug and tug and answer phones and write down stuff and do a little voiceover work and do a little talent, but, Mitch could do anything. When radio started, and this really predates radio. In fact, I remember we met one of these smiling, goofy, long-haired creatures that you saw standing in a black and white photo at the front of the radio station on the day it opened. It was Bruce McKenzie, who was brought in to be the manager of the someday it's going to sign on radio station that KERA was going to have. And Glenn found out about it and became fast friends with Bruce McKenzie because he wanted to be on radio. And it was through the auction that everybody really got to know each other and very well. And he, and sure enough, not only was he there when radio signed on, but he was there for months before radio signed on because Yeah, they were really behind on the carpentry work and lugging and tugging and pulling cables and stuff like that. But then again, Metro could do anything. So Bitch pitched in and helped get the radio station on the air. Jumped several years. We worked during the period. We worked together on all kinds of things. Especially on radio, we worked on sports. It was never a real challenge to do Norm Hitzkus's show. You just sort of said, Norm, so what do you think? Then 18 minutes later, it was sort of, really? But Mitch knew a lot about sports. And in fact, we spent a lot of time together out at the baseball game. And Cowboys, I think for at least 20 years, Glenn had a press pass to the Cowboys and would run down after the game and grab tape in the locker room and run back and cut it and edit it. And it'd be on the next morning on KERA, but it'd also be on NPR, back when the Cowboys were America's team and everybody was following it. And he loved sports, and he really did sports well. And we used to hang out at baseball games together. For those of you who remember the old Arlington Stadium, there was the Blue Box. While Randy Galloway was over spitting on Brad Corbett or, you know, Eddie Childs or whatever poor sucker happened to own the team at the time, we were over there with Eric Nadell before he started doing the Ranger games and finishing off the free buffet. And there was an open bar for a while. And we'd watch baseball game. And Glenn always came with a recorder and a camera. The camera was to get a picture of the no-hitter, of the scoreboard, when the no-hitter took place. And the recorder was to cover the story because it was always going to be a great story. But he was a good sports reporter. But then again, Mitch could do anything. Now, fast forward a few years, and I was doing the sort of a regular on the nightly news show, News Edition, at Channel 13, and business was sort of coming on, and Rukeyser, also known as George Washington in his later years, had proved that business could be palatable to people, and so I got spun off, and they said, you know, we got to put a crew together for you, and you'll need a reporter. And so the question is, really, do we take a business reporter from the Star-Telegram or the Morning News or wherever and turn them into a television person, or try to take a television person and turn him into a business reporter? And I said, I want Mitchell because Mitchell can do anything. And he can do everything. And we had a lot of fun. And that was the four of us sitting there in that other black and white on the set. Believe it or not, that skinny kid was me on the left. It was Mitchell right after, and he was just mad because he had a full beard for a long time. And I made him shave his beard. I said, if we're going to do a business show, we've got to look like business people. And by the way, here's a tie. The guy over on the right was Bruce Deck, our director and cinematographer, and a wonderful guy. The guy on the left, the dark-haired, mustached, very young guy, was a guy named Scott Pelley. I have no idea whatever happened to Pelley, but he's not in Dallas, I know. After that, we really kind of went on, and Glenn came, and Glenn and I overlapped at KRLD, and he did some talk shows there and some stuff, but it really wasn't the right thing. But he could do anything, and he pulled it off, and he did it well. He wrote, he did opinions, but it was about 10 years ago that he, and then under the theory that Mitch could do anything, that he really started doing, I think, and got a chance to do what he really wanted to do. And that was a very magic moment. And that's really where a lot of you all come in, I know. You know him from the last 10 years. And those were, I mean, what a happy 10 years. I mean, God, he loved Susan. He had Susan. He had this radio show. He had this great intellect and this great investigative mind. I mean, he would read books. And then what better thing for somebody who really enjoyed reading books, who was really intellectual, to go out and talk to the guy that actually wrote the book. And ask the questions that were coming to your mind all the time you were reading the book, or who wrote the music piece, or produced the play. It was heaven. Mitch could do anything, but in the end, and for that last decade especially, Mitch was doing exactly what he wanted to do, with exactly the people that he wanted to do it, and living the wonderful life, and it was a great life. And if there's a message to all of us, if there's a message to me, and Norm and I were talking about this just the other night, is I think the message from Glenn to us is enjoy what you do. Do what you want to do. If you're not doing what you want to do, do something else. Because I tell you, from my friend's vantage point, from my vantage point, life is just too damn short. Do it.
God, I can't see my notes. I'm Tom Blackwood. I was very pleased to have been a member of Glenn's Brain Trust for a long time, and I knew Glenn for 25 years. It's altogether fitting that we're on a stage that's dedicated to Christmas, because Glenn will always be inexorably connected to Christmas around here. For the last month of the year, he changed. Okay, he didn't. And for the other 11 months of the year, he could bah humbug with the best of them. You see, my friend was Grumpy Glenn. Oh, I was a fan of the show, and like everyone else, I thought that Glenn was the best host in the business. And in the last few days, the city and the area has poured out these marvelous tributes to this outstanding gentleman, a professional, the truly great Glenn Mitchell. But my buddy was not just the erudite host of hosts. He was the Grumpy Glenn, the man who could take a sip of the milk of human kindness and order a vinegar chaser. A man whose sense of humor dripped with acid. His professionalism would not permit him to insult a guest or be rude to a caller. He saved that attention for his friends. One of the great oddities of life is that the last show we did with Glenn as the Brain Trust was on the topic of things to do before you die. Oh, I have lots of regrets about that and everything else, but one of my regrets was that I forgot to add, live long enough to see Glenn Mitchell buy a round of drinks. The man who could remember what St. Thomas Aquinas had for lunch could forget his wallet with incredible regularity. When we did the call-in show the Monday after his death, it was a tough thing to do, but we enjoyed telling Mitch stories. There was a caller who was one of the many people who called in to express their sadness, and she mentioned how much she had enjoyed Glenn's show and how she felt she knew him, even though she'd never met him. And then she added, "I've never felt that way about a celebrity." The comment went by generally unnoticed, but I had to press the cough button and giggle. I know she meant well and didn't really mean to use that word. I thank her anyway because I always need a premise. But there's two words, there's words in English that just don't go together, and that set of words was Glenn Mitchell and celebrity. The whole concept of celebrity in today's society was anathema to Glenn. He would have no part of it. He didn't interview celebrities on his show, and it would appall him to have that word applied to him. Even if he did aspire to be a celebrity, consider the following. Celebrities do not arrive in an automobile that wheezes to a stop in your driveway. When a celebrity exits a car, the parking valets are supposed to stand in awe of the personality, not in fear of the automobile they have to park. Celebrities do not walk around with cracks in their eyeglasses for 3 weeks on end. Celebrities have cell phones. Celebrities have a sense of fashion. And if Glenn Mitchell had been the kind of guy to give you the shirt off his back, would you really have wanted it? Celebrities make entrances. Mitchell came through your door like a man on a mission, be it to hand you a book, head for your couch, or God help you, your beer. He had no time to stand in one spot long enough to be admired. That's not to say that Glenn was an aw shucks country boy. Far from it. He knew how good he was. He knew how good his show was. And rather than waste time seeking approval and adoration from the masses, he spent time making his show better. Glenn was more concerned about the fame of the Glenn Mitchell Show than he ever was about the fame of Glenn Mitchell. And anyway, the masses are smelly, fickle, ignorant people and buy Britney Spears records. Like I said, I loved the Grumpy Glenn. Those of us who were lucky enough to have known Glenn knew someone who was absolutely real. We were his biggest fans, not for what he did for a living, but what he did in our lives. The folks in the brain trust are huggers. It's always a, hey man, how you doing? Except Mitch. This is Mitchell being hugged. It wasn't from lack of affection. It's just that a hug requires you to stand still. Mitch did not stand still. He was always on the way from somewhere, and being hugged made him stop between where you were and where he was going. Anyway, hug your friends, whether they like it or not. Glenn truly loved doing his show. He respected you as an audience. Check that. He respected most of you as an audience. Okay, some of you. Okay, he really respected Dan from Tyler. The rest of us were always on super secret probation. But, honestly, to him, you were the world's smartest audience. One would expect nothing less for the world's smartest host. So every time you see the word fish written on the back of a truck, thank God for the time we all had, Glenn Mitchell. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we all know how much Glenn appreciated music and how eclectic his taste could be. It's my pleasure to introduce a friend, a guest, and as Glenn would have put it, ladies and gentlemen, the great Josh Allen.
Hello, I'm Glenn Mitchell. Hello, I'm Glenn Mitchell, First Hour Today. Anything you ever wanted to know, among the questions, why do baseball players spit so much? If you lock your knees when you're standing at attention, will you pass out? Hello, I'm Glenn Mitchell. The title of Robert Kaplan's book, All But Demands Attention. It's about the American military's work around the world. It's called Imperial Grunts, imperial as in imperialism. Robert Duvall has been playing lead and character roles in movies on Broadway and on television since the late 1950s. He studied acting on the G.I. Bill and landed roles in plays by Tennessee Williams and Horton Foote, who, in the early 60s, recommended him for the role of Boo Radley in To Kill a Mockingbird, for which Foote wrote the script. Duvall won an Obie for a role in a revival of View from the Bridge and won Oscar nominations for his work in Apocalypse Now, The Godfather, and The Great Santini. The lame juror's personal struggles and the strife within the jury room underscored the humanness of the death penalty decision. Sundby goes into the jury room and the hearts and minds of the jurors for a new book called A Life and Death Decision, Juries and the Death Penalty. Scott Sundby is the Sidney and Francis Lewis Professor of Law at Washington and Lee University. He's worked on both the prosecution and defense sides in a variety of criminal cases and has testified as an expert witness on the death penalty and other legal issues. We're also joined by Dallas attorney Peter Lesser, who's been practicing criminal law since the mid-1970s. When Bob Huffaker, Bill Mercer, George Phoenix, and Wes Wise went to work on November 22, 1963, it was just going to be another day at the office, in this case covering a visit by President Kennedy and Governor John Connally. Cover the arrival, cover the motorcade, cover the speech, the trademark, be done in time for a late lunch. Of course, it didn't work out that way. They were in on the beginning of a new age of electronic news coverage. All the news, all the time. They've written about that weekend in a new book called When the News Went Live. Hello, I'm Glenn Mitchell. A friend said to Greil Marcus not long ago, everyone remembers where they were when they first heard Kennedy was shot. I wonder how many people remember where they were when they first heard Bob Dylan's voice. Marcus knows for sure. He saw Joan Baez sing in 1963, and she invited this friend to come up and sing a couple of songs. He did. Marcus does not remember the end of the show once Baez retook the stage. As he writes, I was transfixed. I was confused, a reaction that people who paid attention to Bob Dylan's work across the course of his career know all too well. It's the 30th anniversary of the release of Like a Rolling Stone. We'll talk with Greil Marcus about it and Dylan. We always talk about, call us from Dallas, call us from Fort Worth, from Denton, from Arlington, from, you know, the larger places. I think this gives people an out. What I think this does, it gives people who live in Myra and Gainesville and Era and Valley View and Collinsville and Tioga and Gunter and Southmeard and Fink and Van Alstyne and Luella a way of saying, well, they aren't actually saying my name. So even though I listen, I don't have to call. People probably think the same thing in Bells and Tom Bean and Howe and White Wright and Pilot Grove and Pilot Point. And Weston and Trenton and Leonard and Blue Ridge and Melissa and Altoga and Farmersville. And they think, because we don't say Farmersville every 2 seconds, they figure, well, he didn't say my town's name. So even though I listen all the time, I don't have to send him anybody. They probably think the same thing in Copeville and Josephine and Nevada and Caddo Mills and Cache, a great town, by the way, to make a pledge from, Cache. And Quinlan and Celeste and Royce City and Fate, if there's ever a town designated for making a pledge, it's Fate. McClendon, Chisholm, Terrell, Greenville. Now, Greenville and Terrell obviously are bigger places, but they're farther away from our orbit. So we're figuring, you think, oh, we can get away with this. We don't have to pledge. Not true. 1-800-456-KERA, especially this hour. Welcome back. Michael York started acting when he was a teenager, kept it up at Oxford, and never quit. He's appeared in such films as Cabaret, Logan's Run, Murder on the Orient Express, The Three Musketeers, the last remake of Beaujesse, two Shakespeare films, all the Austin Powers movies. On Broadway, he's done everything from Bent to The Crucible. He's recorded more than 50 books, including the Grammy-nominated Treasure Island. He's also a writer. He co-authored A Shakespearean Actor Prepares, which The Spectator called a triumph, the most illuminating study of the dramatist since Granville Barker's Prefaces. It deserves to become a classic. Come out and see us. We're at the just outside the Centennial Building on the Esplanade. What should you do before you die? Things like own a boat, meet my childhood hero, find my natural mother, live in Italy for a year, road trip across the U.S., streak naked, which I believe is redundant, and then parachute from a plane.
Then there are the ones from the website we'll get to also. We'll get your suggestions at 800-933-5372, and we'll hear from the boys and girl here at the State Fair. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Mr. Mitchell.
I don't know if Dave also has this one on his list, but to do before I die, and I probably won't, is see the Rangers in a World Series. What do you think our odds are?
Hello, I'm Glenn Mitchell. Trying to pin down Texas music is tough. There's just too much of it, and it's too diverse. Blues and Tex-Mex, rock and roll and pop, rockabilly and classic country, folk and this indefinable stuff. But one person who spent no small amount of time trying to make sense of it all is Joe Nick Petoskey. And we're going to spend the next couple of hours with Joe Nick trying to find out what makes Texas music tick. Just a quick reminder, coming up on Friday, come see us at the library. We're going to be at the library downtown. We're going to be talking in the first hour about energy security in the United States. Our panel will be James Woolsey, former CIA director. We'll also talk with Robert Bryce, author of Cronies, Oil, the Bushes, and the Rise of Texas, and also with David Goldwyn, former Assistant Secretary of Energy for International Affairs. And I get to sort of half take the day off because I will have a co-questioner. Garrick Utley from America Abroad will be there. We'll be right back.
Bob Archenhold is coming forward. We're going to enter into a portion of our service now, which we begin to hear about Glenn, the man away from the mic. Bob is a longtime friend. He'll be followed by Norm Hitchkiss, who not only is a great broadcaster, but was Mitch's roommate many years ago. Bob.
Well, Mr. Marquis said my name, so I don't have to say it. It's printed in your program anyway. And it doesn't matter. I have a little story for you, and every word of it is true. Near the end of baseball season, when the Texas Rangers were safely out of contention, they used to have the broadcaster for a night contest. Winning that contest was my heart's fondest desire, but I didn't make it until 1988. In August of that year, Glenn said, "Listen, rather than write another failed essay, why don't you make a tape of a fake broadcast and enter that? I'll help you make it." So I wrote a script. We met at the radio station. We went into the control booth. I read the script, and Glenn put in crowd noise, sound effects, and edited the tape. You understand, I couldn't possibly have done that on my own. When we were finished making the tape, he cut his eyes sideways at me and said, in a calm and matter-of-fact voice, "Oh, by the way, I'm getting my heart valve replaced next month." And then, immediately, he took a folded paper out of his shirt pocket, and he said, "Now, what I want you to do is order these books from Books on Tape and bring them to the hospital the day of the surgery, so that I can start to listen to them when I wake up." You see what he did? He knew how badly I wanted to win the broadcaster for a night contest, so he waited until after we had made the tape to tell me about the impending surgery, and then he immediately gave me a job to prevent me from being upset. Can you imagine the selflessness and the courage that took? I won the contest, and on the night of the 8th of September, 1988, I got to sit in the radio booth with Mark Holtz and Eric Nadell. And I got to do for one night what I had wanted to do all my life. Glenn listened to the game in his hospital room where he was having some pre-surgical testing done. And I mentioned his name twice on the air during the broadcast and said that I couldn't have done it without his help. The following summer, he and I were out at Arlington Stadium one night, sitting in the stands watching a game, and I told him that in facing down his heart trouble with such composure and such bravery, he had set a standard, an example, that I could only hope to follow someday. And I told him that I could never repay him for what he had done for me, that all I could do was thank him. He just smiled his Glenn smile and said in the ersatz David Niven voice that he liked to use sometimes, "It was my pleasure, sir." Well, if it were his pleasure to help me win a contest, it was my pleasure and my immense good fortune to get to be his friend.
The wonderful acerbic wit of Jimmy Breslin, who wrote in New York for so many years, I got to experience once. Jimmy Breslin ran for office in the city of New York. It was a put-on. It was to just phony up the election. And finally, when it was over and he'd drawn something like 3% of the vote, a reporter asked Jimmy Breslin if he had some regrets. And he said, "Yes, I regret having taken part in anything that caused the bars of New York to be closed for a day." There was something wrong with the small service I was part of last week. It was something tiny wrong. And I couldn't figure out what it was. And I figured it out walking in today. It's that picture. Glenn Mitchell didn't own a tie when I roomed with him. Why have we got a picture up of one of the 3 days in his life he wore a tie? If Glenn were here right now, he would tell you, "I regret being a part of anything that caused so many of you to wear a tie today." When we gather in moments like these, thoughts divide into two groups. Memories that keep flooding back, and what we'll miss so much about the person that caused the creation of those memories. I started rooming with Glenn nearly 32 years ago. He was and still is inside of me. And here are just a few of the pieces of Glenn Mitchell inside of me. Classical music. Max the Dachshund. That razor blade wit. Red wine. Books that I saw him reading and I thought, "I'll never read that." Pledge drives. The meet us at the foul pole baseball games at Arlington Stadium with KERA listeners. That knowing look we exchanged at the racetrack when our horse won. bluegrass music. Occasional late nights at Joe Miller's bar. Political discussions. Sports discussions. Bus trips to Louisiana Downs for the races. Books that I thought saw him reading and I thought, does he really like reading that stuff? Country music. That voice. Sitting in the press box at Santa Anita when Glenn visited me in California, and between races, wondering how a city could so be polluted that we couldn't see mountains that were no more than 5 miles away. That bizarre evening, we took dozens of people to the old Sportatorium for pro wrestling, and afterward, totally invaded and took over a dive named the Triple Nickel Lounge. Discussions about travel. Discussions about food. That feeling that while you so appreciated his mind, he actually wondered what was inside yours. Discussions of rock and roll. Walking through Greenwich Village. Our huge house parties, sometimes with hundreds of people. That look of disbelief we shared when the horse we were so sure of did not win. That crooked, dry smile. Discussions of Vietnam. Discussions of movies. 5 a.m. phone calls to me in Los Angeles to get me up a full hour before the sports spectacular because Glenn understood that without two cups of coffee, I wasn't worth a damn. Big band music. Our "we were so proud of ourselves" idea to spend 1 hour and not 1 minute more cleaning our house each Saturday morning. And if that didn't get it done, whatever didn't get done, we waited until next Saturday. Cold beer. Warm beer. Or basically anything guests at our parties left behind. The Halloween, we went to the station and made tapes of dogs growling and snarling and played them out the window of our big house to totally discourage trick-and-treaters. We did not give away a single candy bar. Books that I saw him reading, thinking, you know, I might actually want to read that one. Discussions of philosophy. Discussions of why does the water run down the drain in different directions in the two different hemispheres? His remarkable 7-Eleven mind, it was always open. The face across the table at KERA, every weekend for 15 years, without missing a weekend. That dog, that voice, that friendship. Glenn Mitchell is gone from this earth, but he lives on and on, inside every one of us. He is the second roommate I have had die. When my first one died years ago, I wrote him a poem, and I'd like to attach Glenn's name to it. This is for Corky Gross, dead in Vietnam, and Glenn Mitchell, dead in his sleep. Someday it'll get us all, you know. We'll run out of Thursdays and birthdays. Perhaps we'll sweat to death in the heat of a dream. Mail will stop, but traffic lights will still change. Wind will blow down trees in the forest. Will there be any sound? Why do garbage dilemmas like that stick on our minds, like dry mud on a wall? What holds them there? What holds us here? We coexist in this junkyard until something comes along to move us around, or cover us up. We are spent meteors, burned, crashed, and stuck in the crust of an earth that cannot throw us up. We are fingers shoved down throats each morning after. We are ghetto tenants whose lease runs out every evening. We rise each day to find a few more of us have disappeared like rain on sand.
We near the conclusion of our service. Bob Ray Sanders, former station manager of KERA, now columnist with the 4-Star Telegram, is going to lead us in prayer. And that will be followed immediately by the wonderful music of Sarah Hickman. When Sarah has finished, the last note has resonated. If you would remain seated, to give Glenn's family the opportunity to make their way up the aisle into the lobby. And then if you would join us in the lobby so we can have a chance to visit, reminisce, tell those stories. Bob Ray was in the room with Glenn the day that KERI went on the air. Bob Ray Sanders.
Before I offer this closing prayer, let me just make one observation and one confession. The observation is, isn't it just like KERA radio to sneak in a pledge break even at a memorial service? You ought to be ashamed, man. And the confession is, and I've told people this, everything I know about radio, I learned from Glenn Mitchell. I know there are a lot of you saying, well, he didn't teach you well enough, but it's the truth. Let us pray. Dear God, Jehovah, Allah, divine creator of us all, as we close this memorial for our dear friend, brother, colleague, we once again thank you for this day, for it is a good day, a glorious day. Despite our sadness, despite our tears, this is the day that you have made, and we shall rejoice in it. We give thanks this day for Glenn, for his having been allowed to dwell among us for as long as he did. Though it was too short a time for us, we are blessed indeed that he passed this way. And yes, we are grateful for that intellect, but even more grateful that he understood how to use it. We are thankful that unlike so many of our leaders today, Glenn knew that you had given him a mind that was expected to be used, to think, to reason, to question. Oh, and we do thank him for the questions and for some of those answers on Friday afternoons. We thank you because when we were suffering in an AM/FM radio wasteland, you sent us an intelligent, comforting voice in the wilderness who caused us to wonder, to reflect, and sometimes to laugh. We pray that you will continue to bless his family, those connected by blood and marriage and friendship, and those thousands connected through the airwaves. And we pray, God, that when you summon the angels to sing for him, that you won't choose just one song. It has to be at least a medley. Let it be a combination of Mozart and Joplin, both Scott and Janis. Let it be the blues and bluegrass. Throw in some medieval chant along with a little rockabilly. Include some country and folk. make sure that there are some melodies that Maria Callas would enjoy, as well as the kind that would be sung by Sarah Vaughan, and Sarah Hickman. In fact, why don't you have the angels sing a new song, celebrating that new star in the sky that will forever shine on all of us who loved him. Please be with us as we depart in peace and unity and love. Amen.
God sent 10,000 angels.